A few years ago at the Wisconsin Film Festival, a documentary called The Linguists was shown. It followed two linguists as they rushed around the world to record some of the last native speakers of languages that were close to dying out.
Estimates are that 7,000 languages are currently spoken in the world. Our guest predicts that between 50 to 90% of languages around the world will be lost by the end of the 21st century. Many of those will be indigenous languages. As we close out Native American Heritage Month, we thought we'd focus in on one effort to preserve an indigenous language here in Wisconsin.
A current project centering on saving the Menominee language just received a grant to further efforts to take older Menominee materials and update them with modern spellings and more current English translations. Joining us to discuss this undertaking is Monica McCauley. She's a linguistics professor at UW-Madison and is working with the Menominee Language and Culture Commission to preserve the Menominee language. Monica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the Menominee language.
Well, Menominee is an Algonquian language, and it's related to other languages spoken in the state of Wisconsin, Potawatomi and Ojibwe. It's very highly endangered. There's a very, very small number of native speakers, elder native speakers, that is, first language speakers, but they have an extremely strong language revitalization program going and a lot of very active second language learners.
So how long has Menominee been spoken in Wisconsin?
The Menominee are one of the few tribes that are still in their original location, their pre-contact location, pretty much. So certainly pre-contact.
And is it spoken anywhere else other than in Wisconsin?
No, it's not.
So this is really a rare language and very, very highly localized.
Yes, definitely.
Well, let's listen to a few phrases.
Poso.
That recording was part of materials made available through the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin's language classes. We heard the speaker say, "Hello, how are you? I'm fine." And you said the Menominee is related to other native languages in the Great Lakes region. Is it related to any languages further afield than that?
Oh, yeah. The Algonquian family is a very, very large family. Stretches from the East Coast, not quite to the West Coast, but you do get Cree and Ojibwe and Cheyenne out west.
Now you said it's very endangered. How many remaining elders are original native speakers of Menominee?
Well, that's a very hard question to answer. I know of one who's still working with me. She's 89 years old, but still as spunky as ever. There are probably some others in the community that I don't know of and who are not interested in working either with me or with the language program, but okay. There's only one that I know of right now.
And were the Menominee one of the native tribes for whom their language was really discouraged by the settlers and by the dominant white culture around them?
Yeah. I don't think there were any that escaped that.
Mm-hmm. So you're working with the Menominee Language and Culture Commission to preserve the Menominee language. It seems overwhelming. Where do you even start when a language is identified as being endangered? First of all, what are those kind of qualifications to be considered an endangered language?
The key thing is when children are no longer learning it. If it's not being transmitted across the generations, then that means the language is in trouble. There are some languages, some native languages, where, you know, maybe they still have speakers in their 30s and 40s, but all that means is that the endangerment is not as severe because if the kids are not learning it, then it's not going to be continued.
So you identify that a language is endangered, and then what's the next step? Is it finding those remaining native speakers?
Well, that can be one of the steps. I think the really critical thing here is that it's not something that a linguist can do. Linguists can be allies in the fight to preserve and revitalize languages, but we're not the ones who do it. The community has to be, it has to come from within the community. And really, over the last, I don't know how many, couple of decades, huge communities of activists have sprung up, and it's really a strong movement right now, and in many cases, linguists are there helping. But we are certainly not the ones who can motivate it or make it happen.
So that goes along with the fact that you are working with the Menominee Language and Culture Commission on this project. Who makes up that Language and Culture Commission within the tribe?
It's appointed by the tribal legislature, and it consists of elders and second language speakers and language teachers, I believe.
And so the commission is identifying this as, well, the tribe is identifying this as a priority and forming the commission, and then you or a linguist like you comes in. What role do you specifically play, and how can you be that support and ally for their efforts?
The kind of things that I can provide generally have to do with the grammar of the language and with documenting the language. So, for example, with the Menominee, they had a dictionary which was published in the 1970s, but actually compiled in the up to the 1940s. So it was published quite a bit after the person who put it together passed away. But it was not very usable because it wasn't using their spelling system, and it only went from Menominee to English. There was no English to Menominee, so there are a lot of problems with it. So one of the projects that I undertook was to create a modern dictionary. And so together we've made two dictionaries, actually. One is a beginner's dictionary, sort of very simple with pictures, and it's organized by topic. And then the second one is, we call it the intermediate dictionary, and it's more of a traditional bilingual dictionary.
Well, in languages, modern languages, languages that are in common usage, are constantly evolving. So was one of the challenges that the Menominee to English dictionary that existed, had the English gotten kind of archaic or out of date?
Yes, exactly. And so one of the things that we had to do is we had to sort of find more colloquial translations for a lot of the words. And then this is not exactly what you were asking, but I'm having a lot of fun right now because one of the things that the Menominee want to do is start an immersion school for the kids. And if you're going to do immersion teaching, you have to have all of the words for all of the things in the curriculum.
Right.
So what we've been doing is we've been working on coming up with words for new concepts. Well, actually, the goal is going to be to teach the whole curriculum in Menominee, if they can get there. It's a lofty goal, but it's what they want to do.
So let's go back. You said that you're working with an 89-year-old native speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you say working with her, what does that exactly mean? What do you do with her?
I go up there about once a month, and we have elicitation sessions. And for a long time, one of the things I've been doing is checking the words in that original dictionary with the elders that I've worked with, to find out if they know them, and then if they do, to get other forms of them. Especially the verbs are extremely complex, and it's really important to get the verb conjugated in a couple of different ways so that you can see the variation that you get in it. So that's why checking the words has been so important. They don't know all of the words in the original dictionary, because the language has changed so much, and a lot of the time it's just not a context that they would have been in to learn the word. I had a funny experience once where I was asking some words that had to do with fishing, and I knew that the person I was working with really liked to fish, but she didn't know any of the words, and I was kind of surprised, and she said, "I fish in English."
So even someone who is a native speaker might not be using that language for everything.
Yeah, exactly. So even when in this particular case, she grew up speaking it, and that was all that was spoken in her home, but she got sent to a school where she was forced to speak English.
So they are teaching a new generation to speak Menominee. Do you have a sense of how many people are studying it right now?
Well, they're teaching it in all of the schools on the reservation. So all of those children are being taught the language. And then there are a number of sort of young adults who are very, very interested in learning it and have varying degrees of fluency.
So as anyone who has studied a language knows, if you don't have opportunities to actually use it and stay fresh, it can get rusty very, very quickly, kind of amazingly quickly, I would say. Mm-hmm. How is the tribe working to make the Menominee language part of everyday life?
The people, there's a term that linguists are using these days that I just love, which is language activists. So the people who are language activists, they're the ones who are just really, really passionate about keeping this language going. They speak it to each other constantly, and they make a real effort, I think, to speak it when they're out in public and to get people used to hearing it again. Now, certainly, you know, they have some things, like in meetings, you know, when there's a motion, instead of saying aye or nay in English, they say the appropriate things in Menominee. But in terms of conversation, it's really the ones who are the most advanced bilinguals, I think, who are still using it on a daily basis.
So as we mentioned earlier, it's the last day of Native American Heritage Month. As a linguist, why do you think that language is such an important part of culture and of identity?
There are a number of ways you can approach that question. I think for a lot of the Native Americans that I've talked to, there's a real sense that their cultural practices are phrased in the language, and a lot of religious matters are phrased in the language. Prayers are in the language. And so a lot of people will say to you something like, well, our language is sacred, which to someone coming from, you know, a Western scholarly academic point of view, doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, I don't identify with that feeling at all. But that's a very strong feeling for people, Native Americans that I've met. And it's just intricately tied up. So another example might be that a lot of Native peoples, if they come from smaller groups, often, you know, they're just localized geographically, and so they're going to have names in their language for everything in their location. They're going to have names for plants and animals and you know, phenomena, which we may not actually even have words for in Western science. So I think the language is often very connected to life and land and religion. It's just integrated into every aspect of life.
Monica, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Sure. My pleasure.
That was Monica McCauley, a linguistics professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's working with the Menominee Language and Culture Commission to preserve the Menominee language.
On this last day of Native American Heritage Month, we want to share an interview by Central Time host Veronica Rickert. She spoke with Native American photographer Matika Wilbur about Project 562. That's her effort to take pictures of members of all 562 Native American tribes to combat what she sees as misrepresentation of them in the media.
Well, how did the Project 562 first come into being? Where did it come from?
Well, you know, I've been a photographer for the last 10 years, maybe 11 now, and I began to realize that there really wasn't an accurate representation of contemporary Native America in mass media, both through the lecturing that I was doing about my previous exhibit, We Are One People and Reemerge, and also just by Google searching. If you type in African American or Asian American, you'll find young, contemporary, or regular folks. If you type Native American, most times what you'll find is an image from the early 1900s. And so my goal really is about creating a positive indigenous role model and new image from this century that represents who we are today.
And I read that there was also a dream that came into play.
Yeah, well, you know, I went to the Rocky Mountain School of Photography and Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara in California. Mm-hmm. And when I was done with school, I pursued advertising in Los Angeles, and I've been working in LA for about, I don't know, 9 months after college, and it was a devastation, really, because I realized that I didn't want to be in advertising, and here I'd studied advertising, and so I took a job in South America, actually, and I went and traveled all through Ecuador and Peru and Bolivia and began photographing indigenous people in the Amazon and in several different places. And I guess I'd been working down there about 3 years when I had this dream with my grandmother. She said, "What are you doing photographing these Indians when you haven't even worked with your own? You know, go home." And I did. I went home to Swinomish, where I'm from. and began my first series called We Are One People, where I photographed elders of Coast Salish tribes, and I asked them questions related to identity and spirituality, love, war. Really, it began my own questioning, what does it mean to be a young Native woman in a contemporary society? How do I learn to balance my cultural traditions with Western value systems?
So you took the advice of your grandmother in the dream, and you talked about the goal of this project to photograph all of the Native tribes in the United States, 562 at this point, and counting, I guess. But you've got a bigger goal, too. You're talking about changing the way people see Native Americans. Why is right now a good time to do that, to put a real face on Native peoples in the United States?
Well, that's a really good question. Why is it necessary? You know, between 1990 and 2000, there were nearly 6,000 blockbuster-released films. Only 12 included American Indians. Of those 12 films, 10 showed Indians as impoverished or beaten down by society. 10 is continually in conflict as white or as a noble savage and spiritual warrior. However, the image of the contemporary business person, the artist, the photographer, the teacher, the doctor, the young professional, those images were largely absent. What's interesting is how that image manifests itself into our psyche. You see, one of my mentors, Dr. Stephanie Freiberg, who's actually from my dad's tribe, from Tulalip, who's a professor from Stanford, did a study. She's a psychologist, and she went to all of these different tribal schools and public schools around the country, and she showed younger kids between ages of 8 and 14 images from different backgrounds. And she would ask them questions related to self-esteem. And then when she would show them an image of a young Native person or of the stereotypical Native person, the Pocahontas, dances with wolves, Twilight, the, God forbid, the Redskins, you know, their self-esteem would go down by almost 60%. And when shown to the white counterpart, their self-esteem would be raised. And so what that tells me is that the image of the Native person is perpetuating this this negativity. And I just think it's time for that to stop, don't you?
I think your images are incredible, and they definitely changed my thinking. They're incredibly striking, and I wonder if you could talk about the ground rules. There's only a couple things you ask of your subjects. What are they?
Well, I ask quite a bit for my subjects. I ask them if I could stay with them.
Besides crashing on their couches, what do they need to be photographed by you?
I ask that they be photographed within their indigenous territory, which usually extends beyond the boundaries of our reservations because, you know, the history of the reservation system has changed quite a bit over the last 150 years. And so within their indigenous territory, and I ask people, which sometimes, you know, I break the rules, you know, like, for instance, Jessica Metcalf is Turtle Mountain Chippewa, but I photographed her on Odom land because that's where we met up. So sometimes I break my own rules. And I also ask them, I ask them where they would like to be photographed in a location that's important to them. And then, of course, there's a series of questions before I photograph them, getting to know them, really asking them questions related to stereotypes and identity. I ask them to tell me some interesting details about their tribe, why they chose to live on the reservation, why they maybe chose to leave, how they chose their partner. We talk about blood quantum, we talk about sovereignty, self-governance, protecting natural resources. It's a very long interview process.
I want to ask you about one of the photographs that you took of Caleb and Jarab Dunlap from the Lake Superior Chippewa. Now, that's our neck of the woods, and they are having a blast, I'm guessing, in Lake Superior. Can you tell us anything about that photo shoot?
Yeah, Caleb and Jarab. They're wonderful. I just love them. And actually, that photograph was taken on the canoe journey out this year at the landing in Quileute. But we are making plans to come to your region, hopefully next spring after the snow melts.
We've got a little bit of time left, and I know you clocked about 60,000 miles on this trip. Can you tell us a couple of the stories that stayed with you from this?
Oh, wow. You know, I have to tell you that the most amazing part of my journey is that I've been really welcomed and taken care of on the road. You know, I think it's really easy for us when we're at home and we're working every day and we're trying to get food on the table and we get caught up in the hustle and we watch the news, and it's easy to be sort of hopeless about the state of humanity, you know. And I just have to tell you that people have been so kind to me and really welcomed me. I don't know how else to say it. It's just been overwhelming. And the incredible support that I've gained through Kickstarter contributors and the media across the country, I think it's what's really inspiring for me has been people are supportive of seeing a change. And that really gives me hope. But, you know, I mean, road stories, oh, gosh, you know, I mean, like traveling in to have a supai at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, that was a wild adventure. And, you know, everything from land controversies and water controversies out with the Paiutes to going to Kachina ceremonies in the Southwest. And it's just been so incredible.
Matika, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I'm really very honored.
That was Veronica Rickard talking with Native American photographer Matika Wilbur about Project 562. It's her effort to take pictures of members of all 562 Native American tribes in an effort to combat what she says are media misrepresentations.